configurational relationalism, which is that there's to be some group of transformations that from a theory's configuration space, and those transformations are physically meaning. One does this because one probably is a sort of luxury of working with theory, so one can work with a entirely gauge and varying quantities. And each of these is implemented mathematically in the program. Which is very similar to Julian Barber's program. These temporal relationisms to be implemented by considering actions that are reparametrization invariant, and that they achieve this reparametrization invariance without appealing to extraneous time-like variables such as lattices. And as a result of it being reparametrization invariant, these actions, the one constraint arises as a consequence of that. And the configurational relationism is to be implemented by considering quantities that are arbitrary G-frame corrected, where G is the group of irrelevant transformations, rather than merely being bare configuration space quantities. So that looks like one is adding rather than taking away, but again, when one takes such an action and one varies with respect to the auxiliaries associated with the group G, one finds that one uses up the degrees of freedom that one brought in with the G, but also additionally an equal number of degrees of freedom from among the configurations Q, so that one ends up on the desired quotient space, which is manifestly doing what the configurational relationism is meant to be doing, which is taking the G to be irrelevant. So we'll be looking at examples of those to clarify what that means. One of which is the relation of particle mechanics itself, and the other one is general relativity, which can be cast in such a form. So let's have some intuitive idea about the particle theories. Okay. Usually when one studies mechanics, one has an absolute origin and some fixed axes, and one describes particle positions relative to those and particle orientations relative to the axes. One can then decide that one is going to use relative separations alone as a different description, and then the origin is no longer relevant, but they're still absolute axes. And a different way of parameterizing this is to think in terms of Jacobi coordinates. Now, one doesn't just consider separations between particles. One's allowed to consider separations between clusters of particles as well. And in doing so, one can maintain diagonality in one's kinetic terms if one chooses Jacobi coordinates. So now, in this particular case where there are three particles, one of the Jacobi coordinates is merely the relative separation between two of the particles, but the other one is the relative separation between the center of mass of those two and the third particle. But there are still absolute axes here because these are ordinary vector quantities. However, if one considers the magnitude of that separation and the magnitude of that other separation and the relative angle between those two, then one has a description which is relational, with the group involved being the Euclidean group. So there are no absolute translations and there are no absolute rotations in this picture. And one can go one step further if one considers only the ratios of relative separations, and then one has relationalism with respect to the similarity group, where scale changes are declared to be irrelevant as well. So one can have relational particle mechanics of this Euclidean form or of this similarity form. Now let's look at what form the actions take and how they implement those principles. Okay, now I'm going to take my starting point to be here. These things up there are more conventional starting points that one might have for these theories, which nevertheless turn out to reduce to this if one thinks those ways rather first. But one can think about it in these terms first. That's what I meant by those relational principles. My relational principles were to be implemented, I remind you, by taking an action of a suitable form. The first thing about this action is that it is indeed reparametrization invariant, which implements the temporal relationism. And it is so because it's the square root of a kinetic term T, which is homogeneous quadratic in velocities. the dotted quantities are the velocity. So being square in those and being the square root of that is overall linear in those. So you can see that if you change the lambda to a lambda prime, it'll cancel with the lambda over lambda primes that one gets from the chain rule within these quantities. So it satisfies the temporal relationalism principle. And then to satisfy the configurational relationalism, one takes an arbitrary Euclidean frame or an arbitrary similarity frame, depending on which theory one's using. And then instead of considering bare velocities like so, one would consider bare velocities with a rotational type correction or with a rotational and a dilational type correction, depending on the theory that one's considering. And then the temporal relationalisms, reparameterization invariant, gives rise to one relation between the momenta of this form, which in this case is an energy constraint, and then varying with respect to whichever auxiliaries one has and which type of relationalism one is choosing to implement configurationally, one has such as a zero total angular momentum constraint or a zero dilational momentum constraint. And then one says, well, that may look like an unfamiliar action to some people, but you see, if you started off with the usual Euler-Lagrange action, right, then you could parameterize it. So now it's being written in terms of a tau, so the dot is a d by d of that tau. And then, given this form here, you can perform the procedure of Rabin reduction to eliminate it, given that the t itself doesn't feature in the action, and then one ends up with that form. So when starting with that as a more conventional picture of mechanics, one could nevertheless show that this picture that I'm talking about is equivalent to that one. And then you can do the same for general relativity. The action that one would strictly take is this one, which is similar to the Baylane-Sharp-Wheeler action, but not quite the same. So again, I'll describe what the action is first and then eventually show that it's equivalent to the Einstein-Hilbert action, if you prefer to think using those as first principles, but these are the first principles that I take. So I'll start with them. So now one has again the square root of a homogeneously quadratic in the velocities kinetic energy term. And that's of this form now, where that is the DeWitt supermetric. And these are the three metrics on a three geometry. And in this case, the configurational relationalism is with respect to the three different morphisms, and one implements that by taking not velocities but velocities that are corrected with the Lie derivatives of the metric variables. And then in this case, the reparameterization invariance gives us a primary constraint, the Hamiltonian constraint for general relativity, and the momentum constraint arises in the usual way by varying these auxiliaries. They're not quite the same auxiliaries that one usually uses. One would usually use a shift here, which is taken to be a coordinate rather than a velocity. But it turns out that the two formulations are equivalent once one does the variation with sufficient care. And then to show that this is equivalent to the usual thing, well, there are two splits, one that gives the Baylane-Sharp-Wheeler one in terms of a shift, and one which gives this one in terms of a velocity, manifest velocity in place of the shift. And then each of those comes through an action which can be obtained from applying split. So one could start with the space-time action up there, then either apply a split that involves the lapse in the shift, alpha and beta, or one which involves the velocity of an instant and the velocity of a frame, which are pretty much the same thing. And if one applies this usual split, one obtains the element there's a mid action, and if one applies that split, then a slightly different action, which for this one, then, the lapse being a multiplier, to get rid of that, one uses multiplier elimination. For this one here, one uses equivalent move, which is, again, a Rabin reduction. So it's exactly the same as that one there to eliminate the velocity with respect to this instant variable. And then, so if one started off with space-time, one could, by applying a split, and then applying that Rabin reduction, obtain the action that I take as my first principle. Okay. Right. So you can see that there's an analogy between the thing that I'm doing and general relativity, and I should point out a few more aspects of that analogy which are going to be useful. Okay. Now you could try doing doing this program again for general relativity, where you take out not only the diffeomorphisms, but some sort of conformal transformations as well. And this will be associated with things which look much like the York initial value problem method. And there is some sort of analogy between doing this and taking out both the rotations and the dilatations by using a similarity particle model. In the case of GR, if one takes out the plane conformal transformations, that one ends up with something like this, the maximal slice condition, which is directly analogous in its form, as you can see, with the zero dilation and momentum constraint of the scale invariant relational particle theory. Furthermore, in general relativity, one could say that one is not going to be taking out the conformal transformations because it leads to frozenness in the case of a theory in a closed topology spatially, or having to choose a theory that's not GR to get past that. If one chooses volume preserving conformal transformations, however, then one obtains a theory which is not frozen and which does reproduce a formulation of GR. So then one would have some constantly in curvature condition like this, instead of a maximal slice condition coming out from the thing. And then this in turn has an analog in the world of the relational particle model, which is that if one takes now the Euclidean relational particle model and treats it in shape and scale variables, then one obtains this thing here as something that one can take as one of one's variables, which is no longer generally zero. And it turns out then that there's a tight analogy between the volume of the universe for this one and the square root of the moment of inertia for that one, and of the conjugate quantities of that, which are the York time for the one here and this dilational object on the other side. And finally, at the level of configuration spaces, the GR one has a configuration space which is the remaining positive definite remaining free metric in the traditional metric variable theory, of course. And then one often takes out the diffeomorphisms to obtain superspace, and then takes out conformal transformations to obtain conformal superspace, or maybe just these volume preserving conformal transformations. So there's a second dotted diamond there. And then in the relational particle models, there's only one diamond other than these two options, because there's no the distinction between a volume preserving conformal transformation and a conformal transformation is a global distinction. So it's a single global degree of freedom that's the difference between that, within a field theoretic context where degrees of freedom are usually one per space point. In this theory here, then it's just a particle theory, so that kind of subtle distinction doesn't exist. So here, one can take out the rotations and pass through a space where one has only relative angles and relative separations as meaningful, and then one can take out the dilations and obtain something which then is a pure shape space. Only ratios of relative separations and relative angles count. So that's a theory, that's the dynamics of pure shape alone. So in each of these cases, there's some kind of analogy. So what do we want to study using a toy model which has a number of similar features to GR, as I've been describing? What we want to study is, at a conceptual level, we want to study the problem of time and quantum gravity. Now, I'll describe the problem of time as being that time takes a different meaning in each of general relativity and ordinary quantum theory, which means that one has a great deal of trouble when one tries to do a theory which is both at once. And then I'll say the problem of time has many facets. A notable one is the frozen formalism, which we've heard in the previous lecture, but it's by no means the only one. And the form that takes when one does simple, straightforward canonical quantization of traditional variables is that one obtains a wave equation, which is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation from the canonical quantization procedure. And one would expect this to be the equation that provides the dynamics, but it turns out to be not have an IHD by D some sort of T of the wave function on this side of the equation. It turns out to have zero. So it's a timeless or stationary Schrodinger equation. Right. So there are many ways to address this frozen formalism and the problem of time more generally that have been put forward over the years. The trouble has been, at least traditionally, that none of them worked when they were examined in detail. And I'll have to show some bias in which ones I talk about. I shall only talk about the ones that my model can address, but there are plenty of other strategies as well that I can tell you about if you're interested in them some other time. So what strategies have been put forward to address the problem of time? Well, they come in a number of families. There are some where the time is an issue to be dealt with before one gets into the quantum mechanics. One is interested in finding a fundamental time for the full theory at the classical level. Given that the equations don't appear to have one, then one has to argue that it is hidden rather than obvious. And the finding of it is, for example, by performing canonical transformations, which eventually reveal that there will be some variable that occurs in there that's momentum going linearly rather than quadratically, from which point when one quantizes it, one will get a Schrodinger equation of that form here. And a particular example of that is that one could use the York time, which is proportional to that constant mean curvature quantity, as one's time. And there's a number of problems with doing that. You know, at least conceptually, it's clear so far. A different strategy is to say, well, there's no fundamental time, but a notion of time can emerge from quantum theory under certain circumstances. And one of the more popular circumstances under which one would like this to emerge is in universes where semi-classical behavior occurs, then time emerges. This is a brief sketch of how that happens. By it being a semi-classical universe, you mean that you have some kind of Born-Oppenheimer approximation, and you're allowed to say that some things are slow and some things are fast, so there's some kind of an adiabatic approximation as well, and there's a WKB approximation. And then one plugs the combined ansatz for those inside one's Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and one finds that one has a term of this form, and then one can manipulate that into one of those, and then one can put that on the other side of the equation, and everything that's left over is an effective Hamiltonian. There may be time, I should check to see if we go through how that goes about. Well, in putting this ansatz in here, right, these double derivatives, you can have one derivative act on each of the two factors, so there's some kind of cross term. And then the h part is an exponent like so, so it has a dw by dh mu nu form. And then one uses Hamilton-Jacobi theory to relate this, which is the derivative of the principal function with respect to the coordinates. So it's the momentum. And then one uses that one can invert momenta and velocities to turn momenta into velocities, although you've had to incorporate the factor of the derivative of the instant, or more commonly the lat, in doing so. But once one has got to this stage, one can use the chain rule in reverse to cancel off across there, and so one ends up with the desired term. And then it's worth mentioning that this semi-classical approach is probably a useful one for quantum cosmology. People like Halliwell and Hawking have done calculations for obtaining microwave background in homogeneities or galaxy formation seeded from quantum perturbations, where the heavy coordinates are the expansion of the universe, the size of the universe, and its conjugate, and the light coordinates are the small homogeneities themselves. That'll be if you get rid of time completely, say there is no fundamental time, and then there are various such approaches. I'll only mention one, which is a records theory, and then I'll say that records theories come in various different forms. There's the conditional probabilities interpretation, there's work of Barber and related work by other authors, and then there's records within a histories theory, which you heard about yesterday, or I'll remind you of it slightly later. And in fact, you can take elements from each of these that are desirable and leave behind elements that are undesirable to try and synthesize what a records theory is, but this is still at a fairly early stage in its development. A record is to be an information containing subconfiguration of a single instant. And it's important that it's a subconfiguration, because the object of the theory is to seek to construct a semblance of dynamics from the correlations between such records, so you need to have more than one. There has to be a subconfiguration rather than the whole thing. And this is the final family of strategies for dealing with the problem of time. It might be that one would not take these records to be primary, but one would take histories to be the thing that one starts off with. And as mentioned there, you can then get reference theory within a histories theory. And it's worth looking at more than one of these approaches at once, because they have certain interrelations between them. So for one, in histories theory, the structure is quite well developed. So I was able to take the ground level framework of a histories theory and write down an analog for it, which applies to a records theory. But there's also other connections as well. It might be that the semblance of dynamics that one gets here has to come from the semi-classical approach's route, rather than this approach being able to produce genuine other means of recovering dynamics that are not semi-classical. And then it may be that semi-classicality itself has something to do with histories decohering, so the approach 2 and the approach 4 may be related as well. So then the models that I'm investigating, they have two desirable features as regards resembling general relativity. They have non-trivial linear constraints, like those zero angular momentum constraints, or that zero dilational momentum constraint, which is some analog of the momentum constraint, and it's a non-trivial analog, unlike in many superspace where the condition merely vanishes. And the other aspect that one is interested in is the idea that one could have small localized clusters of particles, more than one such thing, as a model for small inhomogeneous bumps in quantum cosmology. Now, one can't look at all the approaches to the problem of time using something like a relational particle model, because it doesn't have some of the right features to be able to cope with some of them. After all, it is just a particle theory rather than a field theory, and it has a positive definite kinetic term, whereas GRs is indefinite, and those features play a role in some of the approaches to the problem of time. So we can't deal with all of them. There are a few that we can deal with. As we've mentioned, the relational particle models have an analog of York's internal time, which is that dilational quantity. And the semi-classical approach can also be worked out for them. And they serve as a more straightforward place to try and come to terms with what records theory might be. Because here the kinetic term being positive definite means that one has a notion of the distance between the shapes that are the configurations. And also there's some chance of knowing the microstates, because it's a simpler problem than the quantum gravitational problem, from which we can compute actual measures of information by going from the microstates to the partition function and then having some kind of entropy computed for that, which is to be used as a measure of, or a negative measure of information. So those are the hopes for what one can do with these models. There again, these models are not the only sort of models. I mean, one would look at these as saying, well, this is a similar approach to mini superspace. It serves to illustrate some features, but not others. Likewise, another thing which is a bit like this is studying 2+1 gravity. It's just another approach of those kinds. I'm not claiming then you can get all the answers out from doing this, but if one studies several such approaches, one has several different ways of conceptualizing about the problem of time. And then one can maybe concentrate on what works for all of these and try and push it. I'd be trying to push it into inhomogeneous quantum cosmology and sort of perturbative level, which is analogous to the idea of having a couple of small clusters of particles. So that would be a next step, which is somehow more genuinely like we are, doing anything fairly simple. Okay. Well, what I'm going to demonstrate in this talk is simply that one can do the mathematics of relational particle models that are reasonably non-trivial. From which one can conclude that one can do a number of these calculations for the problem of time approaches and compare them. I won't provide much evidence of the actual doing the problem of time calculations, I'll just provide evidence that relational particle models can be mastered mathematically, at least in some cases. So the first aspect I'll talk about in more detail is the configuration space geometry. Now, it turns out if one takes the constraints that belong to these theories, those zero angular momentum constraints and dilational momentum constraints in the scale invariant case, but if one writes them in Lagrangian form, those constraints then contain those auxiliary variables as corrections to the velocities which occur in Lagrangian forms of constraints. Now one can use those constraints themselves to eliminate these variables. And this can be carried out completely in dimension 1 and dimension 2 for no matter how many particles. And it turns out that in dimension 1, and the configuration space is both metrically and topologically an n minus 2 sphere, where n is the number of particles, and in dimension 2, it turns out that the configuration space is the complex projective space with complex dimension n minus 2, where n is the number of particles, both again topologically and metrically. And in this case, I should say what I mean by metrically. It's not quite so obvious what the standard metric is on one of these. Well, the standard metric on a complex projective space is a Fabini study metric. And then one indeed gets that the reduced kinetic term for these mechanical theories is the one that one has that's built up using the Fabini study line element. So it looks like so, where these curly z's are inhomogeneous coordinates, which are ratios of homogeneous coordinates, which themselves are the Jacobi coordinate expressed in a polar form, and then that polar form expressed in a complex form. And one's had to do a number of transformations in order to eventually end up with that as the form. And then one has in dimension 1 and dimension 2, for no matter how many particles, fully reduced configuration spaces for these theories. And that was done in good part building on the work of Kendall et al., who studied these spaces as abstract mathematical spaces rather than as things to build mechanics out of. And then essentially everything of relevance to these configuration spaces can and has been computed once one has identified that their spaces are simple as that and doesn't have much trouble with the algebraic topology or with the various quantities of the metric geometry that one can obtain. So one has a great deal of control over these spaces. And having obtained reduced theories like so, one can apply reduced quantization to this scheme at a slightly later stage. But I shall only talk about a particularly simple example, so the mathematics is tractable in this talk. And this is the case where there are three particles, the dimension is 2, and it's a scale invariant relational particle model. In this case, the space would be a CP1, but you see there's an accident, which gives you twice as many techniques. In this case, that first complex projective space is also the 2-sphere. So the Fabini study, all those sums in it, they collapse up to this relatively straightforward form, which can be recast like so. And then one can identify those as the stereographic coordinates on the sphere, and one can pass them with a tan theta over 2 substitution to the standard spherical line element for a curvature of 2. I should explain what the coordinates end up being. These are pretty much the ratios of the two relative Jacobi coordinates' sizes. So remember at the start of the talk, one of those Jacobi coordinates was the separation between two particles, and the other was the separation between the center of mass of those two particles and the third particle. So it's the ratio of these two that ends up being that useful coordinate. And this other coordinate here, the phi, is the relative angle between this particle cluster about the center of mass and the last particle. And one has a few extra techniques here too, because one can conformally transform this into the flat metric by taking out the bottom. And if one takes out the bottom like so, the price that one pays is that one's potentials pick up that instead, so they become fairly non-standard. But nevertheless, one has that flat way of looking at it, as well as a stereographic way and the spherical coordinates way. I should also pick a particular potential to study to have a particular example, so I shall pick a triple harmonic oscillator, so there's a harmonic oscillator force between each of the particles involved in the model. And then one has to map to see what this becomes in the coordinates for which the kinetic term is nice in the fully reduced picture. So in Jacobi coordinates, one gets something which looks quite like harmonic oscillators, but it has a cross term in it. Well, some of the easier cases, of course, that can drop out by judicious choice of the coefficients. And then one sees how it transforms into these ratio variables, which are either stereographic coordinates or flat coordinates. And if they're flat coordinates, then you need an extra 2 pounds of 1 Brodhoff square underneath, as all there. But if it was for the stereographic ones, then you'd just have a single power there rather than a cube. And then that's the form that it takes, which is nice and simple in the spherical coordinates. And then there's a particularly simple case hidden within this. It turns out that the constant potential arises as a particular balancing case of this that lies within it, which here is manifested as, well, quite clearly, the one for which B and C are zero, for which a number of conditions like so hold, which means the problem is nice and symmetric. So then the idea is that one can take that constant potential for a sphere, which is a problem that can be solved nicely, both classically and quantum mechanically, and then one can consider perturbations of this kind about it. And one can solve that exactly, at least up to second order or whatever. And then one has good control over the quantum physics of the system. I should mention that this term here is particularly desirable. It is true the calculation would be a lot easier if this term wasn't there, but that would be against the spirit of some of what's being done. Because for the semi-classical approach to work, you need that ansatz, that the wave function has a heavy part which is multiplied by a part which is both heavy and light at once, which means that it's non-separable. If this wasn't there, then this would be separable. That would make the maths easier, but it would mean the semi-classical approach wouldn't work. It would also mean that there's a conserved quantity, which is analogous to the relative angle, which is analogous to angular momentum, but is representing the relative angular momentum between the two systems. And then if one switches on a term like this, then what was a conserved quantity before now becomes a quantity that changes. So if one is interested in obtaining something like a semblance of dynamics, one would be interested in tracking that quantity that changes, although it's a good approximation, it's a conserved quantity. That would be a possibly useful situation to look at for a records theory model. So all in all, we want to keep this term. We may just keep it as a small perturbation, but we want to keep it. We don't want to get rid of it. So what? The classical analysis reveals a number of features that are useful at the quantum level. One is that if one has one of these tilted potentials, where you've got this extra factor of 1 plus curly R squared all squared underneath, that it doesn't matter what form the potential takes. The large asymptotics are always the same. They go as a potential which goes like 1 over R to the 4, which is a furthermore an exactly soluble one, both classically and quantum mechanically, as it turns out. So one has a useful large behavior. The small behavior, however, that having an extra factor of 1 plus R squared all squared underneath, well, if you expand that out at the small level, then that factor goes away, and one recovers at the other end for the small problem asymptotically the usual sort of potential. So one controls both at the large end and the small end. And that was envisaged by solving it at the classical level, but it works at the quantum level too. Probably not worth looking at. Okay. So there's one's quantum problem. There is admittedly another choice that one has to make before one can start one. This problem is complicated enough that one has to think about how one's going to order one's operators before one does quantum theory. The ordering that I choose here is the Laplacian ordering, which is reasonably well motivated, or by no means uniquely motivated. There could be an extra curvature term in it, for example. But taking that particular form, then, one's kinetic term on the sphere looks like an associated Legendre operator, and one would have the associated Legendre equation if one didn't have this b cos theta term and this c sine theta cos theta term. But as I said, we're going to take this b and this c as small perturbations. So at the ground level, one has the Legendre equation. So it's solved by spherical harmonics and whatnot. And then the idea is to end this talk is that I'll show that you can control these terms. And you've got some guarantee of being able to compute those analytically for this problem, so that then one has a full solution for this problem, say without making any semi-classical approximations, that one can compare what you get out of the semi-classical approach out to see whether its assumptions are appropriate and whatnot. Okay. So, repeating what is it working again? Right, okay, so we can do small asymptotics and large asymptotics, and one gets fairly standard problems for those. One gets something which maps to the Bessel equation in the large, and one also gets something that maps to the Bessel equation in the small, but that's somehow too much in the small. That's throwing away the order R squared terms in the potential, if one keeps those but throws away the order after the four ones instead, one gets a more accurate solution, which is this one. So it's in terms of, it looks very much like an isotropic harmonic oscillator. So it's in terms of associated Laguerre functions instead. And then one has these two as exact asymptotic solutions that one can compare what one's doing with. But then, as I say, for the special case where it's just the constant potential after all that sits within there, one can solve it exactly and one obtains the usual spherical harmonics form. Although one has to think that one doesn't just have the spherical harmonics here, because these are fairly contrived variables which arose from doing many substitutions. So what one really is interested in is some reasonably early on variables from one's torque, right? So one recasts those, say, as in terms of the Jacobi coordinates, in which case one has a more complicated form like so. And it's in terms of these that the usual intuitions would be applicable. I mean, one might go even further than this and convert back from the Jacobi coordinates to the original position coordinates. But then, you know, the expression becomes larger and more cumbersome, so I haven't presented it. So you've got to think, you know, the problem that was being set originally was in more or less these variables. And the solution to it is that, which is not so obvious, even though the solution is obvious once one has finally found some good variables to work with. Right. So what I need to show is that you can deal with perturbations of those sorts. Okay, so let's look at them. Let's now do the substitution that cos theta is x. Which would be like the Legendre variable itself, which would be a fairly natural one to look at, I would have thought. Indeed, it is. So the really interesting perturbation is the red one, because it's got that angle dependence that makes it non-separable. So that things that were conserved quantities before aren't anymore, and also it being non-separable, one has a non-trivial semi-classical approach that one can look at. But one can show that both the green one and the red one are tractable in a similar fashion. So one would be doing perturbation theory, so the quantities that one would be interested in are the usual, like so. The background is solved by spherical harmonics, and then the key object you can see within this is this. It occurs within the first order energies and the first order wave functions, and again at second order. So these are the quantities that you're really interested in computing. So the question is, can you compute these exactly when the background is in terms of a spherical harmonics and the perturbations take this form and that form? And then the answer is yes, because you can turn x times an associated Legendre function into simply a sum of Legendre functions using that recurrence relation there, from which point onwards you can take over with orthogonality and obtain something exact. And one can indeed do that again for the other one, because it turns out that there's also a recurrence relation for 1 minus x squared square rooted times of Legendre, an associated Legendre function in terms of a mere sum of Legendre functions. So again, one can use orthogonality, and then one can have an exact answer to these first and second order perturbation problems, so that one has an eigenspectrum correct the second order and the corresponding eigenfunctions. So that's as far as I've got that I could say sort of what you could do then with that, reminding you what the various problem of time approaches have. Let's see. I've got enough time, I think. I can show you the start of the semi-classical calculation, for example. Now I should wait. Stick with this. Right. So. That merely explains again why you want to find dependent potentials have interesting physics. It's written out there. So it'll be the relative angular momentum between that cluster, which is just a trivial cluster of one particle, and this one. That turns out to be a conserved quantity when the potential doesn't depend on this angle between the two. But once it does depend on it, then that becomes a dynamical quantity. Then You could do some work straight away with the calculation that I've got, because you could say, well, are the approximations that one uses in the semi-classical approach appropriate here? So what one does on the one hand is one applies them. So one applies a heavy, slow, light, fast split, and then a WKB approximation, and then one puts that into the wave equation for the system, and then one performs a semi-classical approach on the one hand, and one gets an answer for it. And then on the other hand, one has the exact solution, and then one would ask whether, having done these approximations, the solution that you get after doing them is a good approximand or not of the exactly computed solution, at least the second order again on the other hand. The trouble is, though, that's a difficult thing to sort out. I mean, it turns out that this semi-classical approach problem is again soluble, at least in a particular case, because if this E minus A is proportional to that B, then it cancels out with one of the factors within this Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And then it turns out that one can invert the relation between the WKB time and the heavy variable. And then you see one has an equation for the light physics, which, as I showed in this talk at the start, has an IH bar D by D TWKB of the work of the light wave function as one piece, but it also contains a number of heavy variables, which are here played by the X, which is related to the theta, which is related to the ratio of the separations. So one has to think what's happening here is the ratio of separations between here and here and here and there is changing slowly, but as a dominant factor in terms of how much these various particles weigh, whereas the angle between these two and the center of mass of those and the final particle is something which is moving around sensitively in this particular model, and those are playing the roles of, well, more than quantum cosmology would be the expansion of the universe in some kind of anisotropy or inhomogeneity. So the equation that one has is a time-dependent Schrodinger equation with respect to this WKB time that emerges, but it also contains those heavy variables within it. But if one can invert the relation between the time and that, then all that one's getting is some kind of time-dependent perturbation of a ground time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And again, that's a standard textbook problem to solve. So the trouble is, there's a lot of terms if one looks at these equations in detail. One takes the top equation and one contracts it to form a heavy equation, and then one takes that and subtracts off that, contracted yet again to the light function, and that produces a lot of terms because of the average ones, the non-average ones. There's a lot of terms within there. The ansatz, well, it has two pieces. So these second derivatives produce a number of terms and so on. So I mean, you can see that it's a big complicated problem, and it's difficult to see which terms can be ignored and which can't, because there are so very many approximations. This is all fairly indicative of what happens when you do this for in the general relativity case, because there again you get even more approximations and it's not very easy to track. But it does make comparing the result of doing this procedure with the exact solution somewhat difficult, so it'll take me a year or two to sort it out, no doubt. And then one could make the model more complicated too. One could, for example, study four particles in 1D rather than three in 2D. That also has a two-sphere as its a configuration space, but the potential is mapped to something different. The advantage in that case is that one can generalize to n particles in 1D quite quickly using nd sphere maths, also being fairly standardly tabulated. Or one could study the complex projective spaces in dimension 2 that are bigger than the one that we're studying at the moment, which is just the same as a sphere. One might want to do more of this because the geometry that we're studying is still conformally flat. So it's not particularly general. If one's interested in kinetic effects, which come into some of the aspects of Barber's work. So one might want to study more complicated problems, or one might want to align things more. One might want to make it that you study a Euclidean relational particle model and have the moment of inertia as the heavy variable. So that is even more directly analogous to the situation in cosmology, where that role would be played by a scale factor or a volume or something like that. So one would probably take this calculation that I've done so far as merely a pilot calculation as regards some of these more complicated aspects, and one will need to repeat it. But again, it will be doable. I mean, the maths might be 2 or 3 times longer for these, but these are all also doable calculations, given that I've now got what the configuration spaces are and good variables for investigating the theories. So I can work with any of those and produce analog workings of the problem of time and use them to illustrate interesting things or sometimes shortcomings of those strategies and how those strategies are interrelated. And I'll end there. I'll just put up my list of references to be in the background whilst I answer questions.
Comments?
So I'm interested in the probabilistic interpretation. So if you do this semi-classical approximation, you get a linear, when you get an ordinary Schrödinger equation, you can have unitary evolution, things like that, and you get probably a conservation of probability and so on. Right. And you have a probabilistic interpretation. So in the approximate semi-classical limit, you do have a probabilistic interpretation. What about the exact theory? Is there anything like, you see what I'm saying? Is there any, can you predict probabilities of outcomes or something like that there? Or is it just?
What kind of outcomes? Do you mean any sort of outcomes or specifically outcomes to dynamical questions?
Yes, I mean, when I'm doing quantum experiments, am I always within this approach confined to the semi-classical approximation then, or how do you think about it?
Quite possibly. I mean, the thing is, once you've got a semi-classical approximation, then it doesn't matter that the overall universe is finite, because you're only looking at a piece of it for which the rest of the universe provides a relative timestamp. And with respect to that relative timestamp, and then you can make ordinary sets out of making predictions and there being dynamics and so on.
Yes, but there are no other predictions except that.
The thing is, you see, it could be that the way in which that time standard arises leads to an imprint. I was talking about how you got a perturbed Schrodinger equation rather than just the usual Schrodinger equation, where those perturbations are caused by the external heavy degrees of freedom. So it might be that those leave some kind of a trace indication as to what's causing there to be a time standard. But there's certainly no reason to believe that that would produce anything which is of a size that is measurable in current experiments or anything like that, no.
So let me push the question more. Suppose you can do this division into heavy and light systems.
Mm-hmm.
Can you make any predictions in theory then?
Well, there might be small corrections to one's physics as a result of doing it. So I think that they're going to be so small that you wouldn't be able to measure them experimentally.
So you can make probabilistic statements even in that case. It seems strange to me that there's a fundamental theory, exact one, and then in order to get probabilities and empirical predictions, mm-hmm. you need to do approximations. It should be the case that the exact theory provides you with empirical predictions and probabilities, and then maybe you can approximate those predictions in some way.
No, probabilities are produced by everything. It just depends what sort. If the theory is inherently finite, then it will only produce probabilities about. And given this piece of the universe here has this particular configuration, what is the probability that some other piece of the universe has this other configuration?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So which will be entirely a timeless prediction. And it may be that from that you can infer that there's some sense of history or some sense of dynamics. It looks like these things are changing or something like that. But that will all be a construction that you make rather than something which is actually present in the physics that you're dealing with. So that's how physics would look like in a timeless universe if you took the whole of it at once. But as I say again, if you took a piece of the universe, then the rest of the universe provides a relative time stuff, and then one can do predictions in science and history on a more conventional basis.
Any question? You want to keep going?
I have a second one.
Oh, yes, I have a second one.
So these trajectories which I introduced, it seems like, I mean, they're not there from the beginning, right? Or this is also in regards to the semi-classical approach. So what sort of the ontological status of these things? How could one just at one stage introduce trajectories? I mean, so some people are claiming that well, these are just the Broglie bone trajectories, for example. And one could say, why don't we just introduce them at the fundamental level, at the, you know, the non-approximate theory to start with? It seems a bit strange that one has to use this extra component, which is not there in the theory, right?
Right, but I'm not entirely sure where that enters my talk. I mean, are you talking about my semi-classical approach, or...?
Yeah, I'm just interested in this world, because you do make use of these trajectories in the semi-classical approach, and...
My semi-classical approach isn't any different from anyone else's, except that I have a tendency to keep things rather than throw them away, making lots and lots of approximations. At least I keep note of that. Additional perturbations that one might want to include and see whether they affect. But other than having that attitude, which I haven't really implemented, my semi-classical approach is the same as anyone else's. It's a different problem that's being applied to, admittedly. It's got linear constraints and so on that make it different from the ordinary mechanics or whatever. But the actual steps of the semi-classical approach that are taking part there are all fairly standard, so my attitude to that would be the usual.
Yeah, I agree. But, maybe people
thought right. Any other comments? Concerns? Okay.
Quick question. Are these relational configuration spaces always compact? In the examples you discussed, they are compact.
They become fairly horrible things when one considers them for dimension 3 or higher. The way in which they become horrible, I don't think is non-compact. I think it has to do more with them having singularities. So they do become complicated and unpleasant, but they're not in a non-compact, as far as I know.
Okay.
All right, so let's thank the speaker again. Thank you.